Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, and it's Election Day, and the White House is watching to see if the results of today's off-year races reflect the declining poll numbers for President Bush. Meanwhile, Democrats are hoping for momentum that could lead to bigger gains in the midterm congressional elections next year and the presidential race in 2008. Rick Klein covers politics for the Boston Globe. And Rick, the president made a last-minute swing through Virginia yesterday to campaign for the Republican gubernatorial candidate Jerry Kilgore in Kilgore's race against the Democratic lieutenant Governor Tim Kaine. What does this trip by the president reflect for you?
Well, I think what it reflects is that the president intends to be judged personally on this election. Just a week earlier, the Republican gubernatorial candidate in Virginia elected not to show up with President Bush at a different event. And for President Bush to show up last night, just on the eve of the election, makes it clear that President Bush himself has put himself on the line, his political capital and his political strength on the line, and whether or not he can help Mr. Kilgore be elected governor.
The focus really does seem to be on that race in Virginia and the governor's race in New Jersey, both very expensive. New Jersey in particular, very nasty. And the two candidates in New Jersey have spent more than $70 million?
Yeah, of their own money, which is so go figure that one out. Yeah, that has become particularly nasty even by today's politics. There's been some last-minute ads where Mr. Forrest, or the Republican candidate, has been quoting John Corzine, Senator John Corzine's ex-wife, in a negative way toward Corzine. So that has been a nasty race. It's been considered Corzine's race to lose from the beginning. He does have more money than Mr. Forrester and has spent more money. He's also has won statewide before, but Forrester has closed the gap in the last few weeks, which has given Republicans a little bit of hope that they may be able to pick that state up, although I think most of the conventional wisdom has Corzine winning.
Well, let's get back to those ads, because I was just in New York, and they were particularly ugly and last minute. And again, the ex-wife of the Democratic candidate is in the ad for the Republican candidate,
right,
and she is saying that her husband let her down. He also let the state of New Jersey down. Have those last-minute ads had an impact?
It's hard to tell. I mean, I think there's some who believe that the last-minute negative ads get tuned out anyway. But according to the polls, this race has gotten a lot tighter in the last few weeks. The double-digit lead that Mr. Corzine had about a month, 2 months ago has evaporated, and it's more like 5 or 6 points. So it ends up being about who shows up on Election Day, not just who answers a poll.
Well, and just a year ago, the president won a second term and won larger majorities in Congress. And now, as we said, he has these receding poll numbers. So the Democrats feel they have a lot riding on today's results.
Yeah, you can make the argument they actually have more riding than the Republicans, because both of these two governor races that we're discussing are currently controlled by Democrats. So Republicans make the argument that all the Democrats did was hold serve here. They just won states that they already controlled, and really they need to have a big day today to help their recruiting and help their fundraising for 2006 and then beyond. Mm-hmm. So I think Republicans can declare victory if they hold on to just one out of the two. If they win just one out of those two governor's races, because they're going to win the other highest profile race on the ballot, the mayor's race in New York City. Almost certainly Michael Bloomberg is going to win re-election there.
Most of the local races do seem to be about local politics, as Tip O'Neill famously said. Here in Massachusetts, there is a mayor's race, but it does seem to be all about local issues. Are there any other races in the country, though, where the president or national party politics are considered part of the race?
Well, there's a very interesting race in St. Paul, Minnesota. The mayor of St. Paul, the Democratic mayor of St. Paul, endorsed President Bush last year. He's getting trounced, according to the polls, by as much as 40 points by another Democrat, a Democratic challenger, and President Bush has been a major factor in that race. Another one where it's a little bit interesting is California. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger pushed to have a initiative petitions on the ballot. There are four of them that he's very actively worked for, and he was very popular Republican governor as recently as a year ago and did campaign for President Bush and endorsed President Bush, spoke at the convention. He looks like he's going to lose them all. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of ones that are being watched for those kind of implications.
Rick Klein, he covers politics for the Boston Globe, speaking to us about today's races on Election Day. Rick, have you voted yet?
I live in Washington, D.C., and
all
it's
right.
Not Election Day here. So.
That's your only excuse. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Iraqi defector, who provided the Bush administration with what is now regarded as faulty pre-war intelligence, begins mending fences in Washington today, and Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Ahmed Chalabi will meet with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld later this week. Chalabi fell out of favor with the U.S. after the invasion of Iraq, and last year he was accused of passing secrets to Iran. Also today, a bipartisan group of senators begins mapping out phase two of the investigation into how top officials in the Bush administration handled pre-war intelligence and whether they misrepresented that intelligence to the public. Part of their investigation are some now recognized forgeries that claimed Iraq was buying yellowcake uranium from the African nation of Niger. Well, today we're going to take a closer look at those Niger documents with Philip Giraldi, a former CIA counterterrorism official. He was with the agency from 1976 to 1992. He also worked as a CIA contractor just after 9/11, and he's written about the Niger forgeries for the American Conservative magazine. Phil, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Let's remind people of the timeline. Prior to these documents that we're talking about, the Niger documents, there was separate earlier intelligence claiming that Iraq was seeking yellowcake uranium. Do we know what that intelligence was, where it came from, and what it said?
Well, there was quite a body of intelligence relating to Iraq's alleged search for yellowcake uranium, and indeed, in the period of the 1980s, it wasn't alleged. It was actually Iraq was searching for uranium supplies. The big question became: was there any active effort after that time? A lot of the intelligence that was developed to support this theory was derived from foreign sources. It came from. The British claim to have had a source that they've never actually revealed much about. The Italians had this dossier. There was also information that was being collected by the Defense Intelligence Agency. The information, was never really found to be extremely credible, but it was considered to be plausible that Iraq was still involved in this kind of program.
So what happened then? The CIA had this intelligence. We know that Vice President Dick Cheney's office was particularly interested in it. So what happened then?
Places like the Department of Energy, which has its own intelligence group, DIA, CIA, were all very skeptical about the information that was being developed. And Cheney essentially put pressure on the system to try to develop additional information.
But did Vice President Dick Cheney's office send Joseph Wilson to find out if this intelligence was true? And that's, of course, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Or did that trip come from within the CIA?
Well, the trip came from inside the CIA, but it was reported to be at the request of the vice president, who wanted to confirm, if possible, that this information on the attempts to buy yellowcake was accurate.
So former Ambassador Joseph Wilson is off to Africa, of course, on the recommendation of his wife, Valerie Plame, who worked at the CIA. What did he say after his trip regarding the claims of sale of yellowcake uranium to Iraq?
Okay. Now, bear in mind that the forged documents that we're talking about in this case,
they haven't even come out yet.
Right. He hadn't seen them. He went to Niger. He questioned people in the government. He questioned people in the French consortium that was running the uranium mine. And he came back and he said basically that the information was bogus.
Well, let's do a timeline of the documents as far as we know. Before the 9/11 attacks in January of 2001, there was a break-in at the Niger embassy in Rome. There is some speculation that the letterheads on which these documents appear might have been stolen at that time.
I don't think that it's speculative. I think it's definite. There was the break-in took place, and documents and letterhead and signature samples were stolen, but no valuables.
So this was before even the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, this is in January of 2001. The speculation in the Italian media was that this break-in was intended to steal the documents to pull off basically a scam against the French contractors that were running the uranium mines in Niger. This is all kind of complicated and far-fetched, but there seems to be some evidence to suggest that this was why the documents were stolen.
Well, what happened next with these documents?
Well, then it becomes a little bit murky, but the documents somehow found their way into the Italian Intelligence Service dossier on Iraq and uranium, and they became part of it. when Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and his intelligence chief, Niccolo Pollati, went to Washington 1 month after 9/11, they were very interested in supporting the case against Iraq. And they produced this dossier. Now, the dossier, to a certain extent, relied on the documents, but it did not include the documents.
Well, and how was that intelligence received by the CIA or the State Department?
Skeptically. They looked at it, and also the Defense Intelligence Agency had looked at this material, and they decided that it wasn't credible, it wasn't substantiated, and they basically told the administration that this was not reliable information. The Italians then tried to, they beefed up this dossier a few months later in February and tried to replay it, but again, there was not very much interest in it. And that's when the vice president triggered this trip.
Joseph Wilson's trip to Niger in February 2002. Well, then as our timeline continues, 8 months later, a former Italian intelligence agent named Rocco Martino surfaces with the actual forged documents, not just the information in the papers. He offers them to an Italian journalist working for a Berlusconi-owned publication for $10,000. She turns down the deal, so he just gives them to her. She gives them to the U.S. Embassy in Rome, and an American named Michael Ledeen surfaces. Who is he?
Michael Ledeen is a leading neoconservative who has had long ties to Italy and to the Italian intelligence services. The way the Italian investigative journalists who have been following this reconstructed, Ledeen essentially enabled Pollari, the head of the intelligence service, to do an end run around the CIA because the CIA was being skeptical about this intelligence.
And do what? What did he? What was he
well,
able to
he
do?
Well, he got him into the National Security Council, where he spoke to Stephen Hadley.
What about Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi exile who had the ear of the White House in the run-up to the war? Do you think he had a hand in the forgeries?
I don't think so, although that has been suggested. I think there's a problem maybe in focusing too narrowly on the Niger documents as the issue. I think the real issue, and this is, of course, what the Senate is trying to come to grips with right at the moment, is the whole mass of fabricated intelligence that supported the Iraq War. There, virtually all of the information that was used to support Iraq's having various kinds of weapons of mass destruction and delivery systems was fabricated. Most of it was fabricated by Ahmed Chalabi. This Italian case is just almost a sidebar to it. A lot of the information, of course, wound up in the New York Times.
That's Philip Girardi. He's former CIA counterterrorism official and columnist for the American Conservative magazine. He's going to be back with us in a moment to talk about the fallout from the faulty intelligence in the run-up to the war in Iraq. And while we have him, we're going to also ask him about those secret CIA prisons and the move to allow CIA agents to use torture. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. We're continuing our conversation on the accuracy and use of spy intelligence leading up to the war in Iraq. Today, U.S. senators are beginning phase two of an investigation into whether the Bush administration exaggerated or misused that intelligence. And the Washington Post is reporting that Democrats and Republicans are tussling over whether to just compare what was known about Iraq before the war with what was said about Iraq, or whether to expand the scope of the investigation to include new interviews with administration policymakers. Well, Philip Girardi is with us again. He's a former counterterrorism official with the CIA and a columnist for the American Conservative magazine. And, Phil, you say that much of the pre-war intelligence was fabricated, but if it was faulty, how did it reach the top policy level? The forged Niger documents, for instance, went right to the White House. President Bush spoke about them and spoke about the uranium claims in his State of the Union speech in 2003. Of course, the White House later retracted those 16 words.
That's right. I mean, the Pentagon had an office that was called the Office of Special Plans that was set up under Doug Feith that was deliberately set up to pull in information that the major intelligence resources, DIA, CIA, State Department, considered unreliable. And they then took this information, and the expression is stovepiped it, which basically is you create a channel which goes down from the bottom where the intelligence is collected up to the policymakers without going through the normal checks and balances that would be exercised by the intelligence community.
Such as? What are some of the checks and balances?
Well, the checks and balances would be that you have extremely experienced analysts throughout the, you know, there are 27 different agencies that represent the intelligence community in the United States, and they all have a chance to look at this information and to say whether it's credible or not.
But instead, it went right to Doug Feith's committee.
Well, it went from Doug Feith's committee up to the White House.
Do you think that the U.S. had a hand in the forgery of the Niger documents?
Well, of course, that's the $64,000 question. I think it's clear from the evidence that's been collected in Italy that the U.S., through the Office of Special Plans, through the Pentagon, was instrumental in getting this information into the system and up to the policymakers, where it essentially poisoned the deliberative process and came out with a wrong answer. Whether there was a hand in forging the documents, well, I think will only emerge if there is a comprehensive investigation.
Well, now, if you said there is an investigation into this intelligence in the run-up to the war, the CIA has claimed all along that it got the intelligence right. And now, because of the Plame investigation, we see how strained the relationship is between the CIA and the White House. Many officers leaving the CIA since the president appointed Congressman Porter Goss to lead the agency. So, a couple questions about that. What is morale like at the CIA?
Morale is awful. The recent report that you saw in the newspapers last week about the secret prisons and everything, for example, was, to my knowledge, leaked by senior CIA officers who were fed up and who felt that this was just one more, you know, spike in the coffin with laying this use of torture onto the CIA, which 99.9% of CIA officers would wish to have nothing to do with.
Yeah, and how much is national security compromised because of the turmoil and the exiting at the CIA?
Well, you're losing a lot of people with a lot of experience. You're losing people with critical languages. That's really, you know, when you look at the whole history of the failures against terrorist groups and that kind of thing, a lot of this goes back to having insufficient resources in terms of people who were culturally able to work in against terrorist groups, or who had the languages and other skills, and these are a lot of the people you're losing. So yeah, there is kind of a payback, unfortunately, on this.
Well, and on a related story, reports last week of these secret CIA-run prisons around the world holding detainees, and allegations of torture happening at those prisons. Does the CIA torture in secret prisons? And if not, why is Vice President Dick Cheney pushing for an exemption for CIA operatives in a measure to ban torture?
Yeah, well, I would say that, and I don't know specifically whether the CIA has been torturing people. I assume from the press reports, which seem to be credible, that there at least some of this has taken place with some prisoners. As I suggested before, most CIA officers would want to have nothing to do with this kind of activity.
Really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's not the perception.
Well, the perception is, I think, wrong in this case. The CIA is not the one pushing these sorts of agendas. This is coming out of the vice president's office primarily. Cheney, I believe, in my judgment, has a warped perception of the value of torture as a counterterrorism tool. They always cite the example of, well, you capture a terrorist and he's just planted a bomb and you have to know where it is to save lives. Well, in reality, that's not what it's all about. That almost never happens. That I know of no case where that has happened. This is basically a perception that if you torture people, you're going to get information. But most intelligence professionals, whether in the Defense Department or in CIA, would tell you this is nonsense. Torture is not an effective way of getting anything.
Do you see any way to repair what appears to be a huge schism between the White House and the CIA?
Actually, I don't. The morale issue at CIA is so low. The vice president's office, which is driving a lot of this, is so hostile to CIA. The only way I think it'll change is when there's a change of administration, or if Dick Cheney somehow leaves as a result of the current problems.
And in your mind, how much is the CIA responsible for the current situation? Because we read that Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby and others this relationship began because of their anger at the CIA for not knowing about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction after the first Gulf War and the resulting genocide when he killed the Kurds.
Well, the reason why the Dick Cheney and the White House were mad at the CIA was not necessarily over that. It was over the fact that the CIA was not producing intelligence to support what they wanted to prove, which was essentially that Iraq presented some kind of threat to the United States. The CIA was not able to produce that information because it didn't exist.
Philip Giraldi, he's a former CIA counterterrorism officer and a columnist for the American Conservative magazine. He's been writing about the Niger documents. And tomorrow on Here and Now, this note, while the riots in Paris continue, we ask what's fueling the anger of Muslims in France and will the violence spread across Europe? Also, Democrats and Republicans read the political tea leaves following the off-year elections. That's all tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now come
now. Cases that have come before the Supreme Court since Roe v. Wade gave women the constitutional right to an abortion have slowly but radically altered access to that procedure. That's the claim of a new Frontline documentary airing on PBS stations tonight that examines how state governments have crafted their own laws that place limits on abortion. Here are two participants in the film. Betty Thompson is a former abortion clinic director, and first, Terry Herring, the president of Pro-Life Mississippi.
People have persistently and continually said that we do not want abortion in Mississippi.
Their tactics changed. They began to see we have political clout now. And so while we have this power, we are going to chip away at Roe versus Wade until the law is going to be on the books, but nobody will be able to access the service.
The Frontline film is called The Last Abortion Clinic. We're joined in the studio by its producer, Rainey Aronson. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Last Abortion Clinic, you zero in on a battle over the last abortion clinic in Mississippi. Why Mississippi?
We wanted to go to a state where the state has been very successful with passing pro-life legislation, and Mississippi was one of those places.
And Mississippi's laws include a 24-hour waiting period, other strict requirements to get a woman to think before going through the procedure. You spoke to State Senator Alan Nunnally, who helped craft the restrictions. Let's listen.
We required the informed consent to be doctor to patient, face to face, to include a booklet of color pictures showing fetal development and requiring the doctor to point out to this woman, okay, this is where your child fits into this spectrum of pictures.
And Rainey Aronson, in the film Elsewhere, we see that other states require women come back once, maybe even twice, before they get the procedure to get counseling. Other places show them sonograms. And I know, because we spoke a little bit before, that you are hearing from women, and I also had the same thought, that women might be saying, some women, especially of a certain age, might be saying, well, what's wrong with having women get counseling? You know, I wish I had thought a little more. I wish I'd just taken some time and had counseling. You did hear that, didn't you?
I did. I actually heard that from women, especially women who had abortions in the late 70s and early 80s. But what I thought was really interesting about the debate now is that a lot of the people from the pro-choice side, they believe that a lot of the state-mandated information is actually very biased. And they believe that really this informed consent, what's called informed consent, is really trying to talk a woman out of having an abortion.
Well, you also have a director of a clinic that offers abortions in another segment of the film offer another answer to that question, you know, what's wrong with this? Many women can't afford the time that the counseling calls for.
We don't think about things like long distances, driving for 3 or 4 hours, getting 2 days off from work. These are the types of barriers.
These challenges to access to abortion came about because of the Casey decision, which has been much discussed in the last few months as we've seen Supreme Court nominees. Could you just tell us briefly, how did Casey open what some would see as these floodgates?
Casey basically upheld Roe v. Wade. It said that, you know, it is still a right for women to be able to access abortion, but at the same time, it did something very radical. It opened up the doors to states to be able to move to pass regulations such as the 24-hour waiting period, informed consent, parental consent, all sorts of things that the states were then allowed to do that they never had been allowed to do beforehand.
Well, you go to the Delta, that's the poorest part of the state. Most women can't afford an abortion procedure. They can't travel to the last clinic, which is up in Jackson. They also have one of the highest teen birth rates in the country. And we meet Patricia White, an OBGYN nurse. She works in a public health clinic. Let's listen.
These women really don't have a choice. We are making decisions for them. It's like even before Roe v. Wade.
Rainey Aronson, what did the pro-life advocate say in response to that?
It was actually one of the most interesting parts of the film. When we asked the pro-life movement, and in particular Tara Ehring, what did she say to the lack of access for poor women, particularly in the Delta, she had a very frank answer. Her answer was, you know what, we do not believe abortion is an option or a good option for women under any circumstance. If they are poor, the answer is not abortion. The answer is helping them in other areas, giving them other things, helping them, but not giving them an abortion.
In fact, one woman said, I was poor and I and God helped me.
Right, and that's really their answer. The bottom line is they believe that God will help these women, and that's really the bottom line.
Well, Mississippi will not allow any public funds, including Medicaid, pay for an abortion. But someone in Mississippi can buy a license plate that says Choose Life. Part of the money that they pay for that will go to a fund that pays for crisis pregnancy centers around the state where women who are pregnant get counseled. But if those women who go in for counseling ask to be directed to an abortion, the people in the crisis pregnancy centers will not send them there. Let's listen to Director Barbara Beavers.
We don't refer for abortions. We don't give them the numbers of the clinic because that to us would be harmful to her health.
Is that legal? Can they do that, not recommend what is a legal procedure?
Actually, there's no law that says that you must refer to an abortion clinic. In fact, these crisis pregnancy centers are not really state-funded. In other words, they do have the separate fund that money goes towards that then is given to these centers, but they're not actually state-funded. Mm-hmm. The other thing to know is that the state of Mississippi has very strict laws against state-funded hospitals actually offering the procedure. So they're against any institution that receives state money from being involved in abortion.
Well, you spoke to the director of a clinic that does offer abortions, and she said actually that the pro-life movement has been so successful in whittling access to abortion that she was actually finding herself wishing for a huge failure for her side. Let's listen to her speak while people sing outside of a clinic protesting abortions.
Sometimes I fantasize about Roe being overturned because then I think that there would be this real threat, this real enemy, as long as everything flies below the radar, never an all-out attack. I think that most women and men are asleep. I don't think they realize what's going on.
Well, the Supreme Court is slated to hear an important New Hampshire abortion case at the end of this month, Ayotte versus Planned Parenthood. It has to do with the health of a minor. What's the impact of this case on abortion access?
Well, it's a very important case. It's actually one of the biggest cases that has come before the Supreme Court, only the second major case since Casey. And what's important is that in every single abortion case that's gone through the Supreme Court, there has had to be an exception for the health of the mother, if you're a minor or not a minor. It doesn't matter, the health of the mother. And what this case is challenging is whether or not there needs to be that. In other words, this law that's in front of the Supreme Court that they're going to look at doesn't include any exception other than in the case of imminent death for the minor. So if the Supreme Court says that it's okay for this law to stand, it could have huge implications for other abortion laws that will come down the pipeline in the future.
In other words, there would be precedent set that it would have to be imminent death of the mother.
It could be. I mean, we never know what the Supreme Court's going to say, but one of the ways that they could rule, certainly based on the New Hampshire laws, they could say this is a valid law, and they may actually only only restricted to minors. They may open it up to women of all ages. We just don't know.
Rainey Aronson, producer of the Frontline film, The Last Abortion Clinic. It airs tonight on most PBS stations. Rainey, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And you're listening to Here and Now. With gas prices still high across the U.S., many people are becoming more creative about fuel conservation. 86-year-old Frances Crowe of Northampton, Massachusetts, is doing her part by hitchhiking. She is part of the group CommuniGo. It's in the beginning stages of promoting organized hitchhiking in the Pioneer Valley of Massachusetts, home to many colleges such as UMass Amherst. And Frances joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what inspired this idea of communal hitchhiking?
Well, you know, as we face, you know, the evidence out about peak oil and many people feeling that individual driving of automobiles is the most high use of the oil that we have left.
And peak oil being the idea that the oil is going to run out.
Exactly. And that, you know, so much of our society is dependent on the use of oil.
Now, tell me your thinking. How would CommuniGo work? We understand that, you know, it's in the planning stages, but people would actually register to be a part of it?
They would register, and drivers and riders would both supply a photo ID, two reference letters, and the drivers would have to prove that they, of course, had a valid license and the car was inspected and insured.
Right. And insurance would tell you what kind of drivers they were, if they had any problems in the past.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the driver is always responsible for whatever happens when he's or she is driving, so the liability issue came up very quickly. But we're working with lawyers in developing a waiver form for drivers and riders.
Well, and we understand that each of the drivers and the riders would have placards so that somebody standing on the road could hold up their placard, and if someone pulls over, they could show their placard and they could know that they're both part of CommuniGo.
Exactly. And numbers on them so that if you have a question, you know, you'll see you're getting into a car that the driver is number 8. And we're, you know, urging people when they step up to the car to say, where are you going? So they, you know, kind of have an exchange and see face-to-face one another.
Well, you know, people might still worry about safety because you might know how good a driver someone is, but you might not know about their criminal history.
Well, that is true. Mm. But, you know, with letters of reference, and one of the things that we're going to have to do for the future is try to learn to trust one another more and build community.
Well, I should say that your police chief out there in Northampton says he thinks it's a really good idea because at the very least, because everyone's names will be in a register, he'll have a database. So if anything goes wrong, he'll at least be able to track someone, which he can't do now with the many hitchhikers. And I guess I just wonder, I mean, you're 86 years old, Frances. Do you plan to be a picker-upper or a hitchhiker?
Well, I think I'll be a rider more often than a driver.
And you don't? Do you have concerns about getting in cars with people you don't know? Or?
No, no. I, you know, a lot of people know me, and I feel very safe looking at a person and getting in.
Yeah, and some have said that in addition to saving on fuel, this does become a socializing factor in places where people rarely talk to other commuters.
Exactly. And, you know, I think a lot of young people don't want to deal with the post-carbon world. They feel too depressed. And this is a way they don't have to depend on Congress people to take action. They can take action in their individual lives.
Hmm. Well, I understand when you first moved out there to Northampton in the 50s, you picked up hitchhikers all the time.
Of course. Everyone did because there were no buses and students didn't have cars in those days. So that there was a wonderful feeling of sharing and community. And that's what we hope to recreate.
Frances Crowe, part of a group of people in Northampton, Massachusetts, who are trying to organize community hitchhiking. Frances, thanks very much for speaking to us about it.
You're very welcome. And one of the great things about this, it'll help clean up the air we breathe.
Well, you have such great air out there in Northampton anyway, but thanks for thinking of the rest of us.
You're welcome.
Frances, thank you.
All right.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Harvard researcher Peter Nescrecki is a true Indiana Jones, braving the jungles of Costa Rica and the African desert, suffering disease and hair-raising escapes, in search of bugs. Beautiful, astonishingly resilient bugs. Peter has been documenting the 90-plus percent of the world's species that are smaller than a human finger, and he shares his finds in a spectacular new book of over 400 photographs of insects, reptiles, and amphibians, what he calls the smaller majority. You can follow along on our website, here-now.org, as we look at the pictures with Peter Nescrecki, who joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Smaller than a human finger?
Yes, actually, most of them would be probably smaller than a human fingernail.
You also say that the things that are smaller than a fingernail, we assign all this horror to, you know, bugs we don't like, when in fact we're more likely to get killed by a cougar.
Yes. It's very difficult to get over of this innate fear of little things.
But not you, Peter Nescrecki. Here in the beginning of the book is a photograph of a little boy in a white T-shirt with two, looks like lizards climbing up his chest. Is that you?
Yes, it's me with two lizards, yes.
So this started early for you. What prompted your love of little insects?
I don't know what actually prompted it, but my absolutely earliest memories from my childhood are memories of playing with snails or playing with frogs or waking up in the morning and finding a jar with a frog that my father had caught for me. So those memories have shaped my life, and I've always had a fond, love and fond memories of little things.
I've got your book open to the page where we see the plant hoppers. It's a glass frog. What's the official name?
A Hyalina batrachium valeri.
There you go.
Yes, this frog belongs to a group known as glass frogs, and the name is quite accurate. These animals are pretty much transparent. They do it by basically saturating their bodies with water, and their skin is completely translucent, so the light passes right through them, and they basically disappear on any substrate that they will sit on. It's a very effective technique of camouflage.
It's amazing. I mean, all you see are two eyes. Well, the book is in three sections, and each you go to endangered ecosystems around the globe, humid forests, savannas, deserts. We'll get back to, you know, some of the little things you found, but what happened to you in these travels? I mean, the diseases, the near arrests, what were some of the things that...
Well, probably the most potentially dangerous encounters I had were being bitten by a poisonous viper or getting all kinds of really unpleasant parasites like typhus.
And yeah. Then there was the time you accidentally stepped onto a marching column of driver ants.
That actually happened to me more than once. These animals are very, very aggressive, and they pursue you. The soldiers will actually chase you short distances, luckily. But they are unbelievably fast, and they will swarm all over you within seconds, and the only way to get rid of them is to very, very quickly strip and then pick them individually as they latch on your skin.
Almost swept by a flash flood in Namibia just after surviving a fall off a cliff. As you said, bitten by a deadly viper. That was in Poland. Why? Why do you? Why would you put yourself in this situation?
I think it's a very, very small price to pay for being able to actually experience life to its fullest in all these fantastic ecosystems. So I really do not regret anything that happened to me or may happen to me in the future.
I'm looking at one of the, you know, results of one of your exploits. It's the picture of the praying mantis. Just exquisite. And, you know, when you see that, this is in Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gorgeous picture of a praying mantis with a big glowing sun. I mean, this is, you know, beautiful artwork as well as, you know, scientific. What's it like when you are looking up? I think those are his eyes. When you are looking a praying mantis in the eyes.
I think I am making a connection. Of course, that doesn't really happen with these types of animals. They don't have the same type of emotional life we do. But I just love when I can make an eye contact with small animals. And mantids are particularly good at that. They actually will follow your gaze. So when you photograph mantids, they know you are there, and you have to be really, really careful when you take these images.
You write that as tragic and unforgivable as it would be, the disappearance of mountain gorillas would have far smaller ecological repercussions than the extinction of a single species of savanna termite. Now, we are very concerned about mountain gorillas, but why are the termites so important?
Oh, without termites, there would be no savannas. Think about it. You have these billions and billions of blades of grass, some of which will get grazed by big mammals, other will get eaten by grasshoppers. But the most of it will eventually wither and fall to the ground. If there wasn't something that removes these grasses and recycles them, then within a year or two, the entire African plains would be covered with feet and feet of dead grass, eventually choking the entire ecosystem. So termites are incredibly efficient recyclers of biological material, and they allow for the new generation of grass and other plants to grow.
Okay, that's fine, but now I'm looking at the dwarf chameleon. How would you describe it? It's like a Star Wars character.
Exactly. I think of them as little Yodas. They have these very even when they move, when you look at them, they behave like a Yoda. They have big eyes, they look at you, they make this emotional contact with you. And so yes, they are like Star Wars characters.
It does look like Yoda. I'm looking at the mouth and the eyes, although it has four, well, Yoda has four. Like, you never get to see his feet.
Actually, these chameleons, you often see them climbing on vegetation, and they will sometimes use just their tail and their hind feet, so they are basically standing upright. So their resemblance to a Yoda is remarkable.
Here's the walking leaves. Look at that. They look like brown leaves, which I guess are their wings or something, with green, almost grasshoppery legs, and huge, long, green, light green antenna coming out of their head. Mm-hmm. What do they do?
Well, these walking leaves are actually katydids. Katydids are those insects that sometimes come to your porch lights, green things that sing high in the trees at the end of the summer. But there are more katydids than just those green things. These walking leaves are just absolutely exquisite mimics of leaves. I cannot think of a better example of mimicry in the animal world than these things. Mm. I have never, in over 10 years of working in the tropical rainforest, I have never found one during the day because they are so superbly camouflaged. You can only find them at night when those long antennae that you mentioned actually move slightly. So in the still air of the rainforest, you can actually see the movement of the antennae in your headlamp.
And we understand you have a particular relationship with katydids. First of all, you had your foot punctured by a rusty barbed wire while you were collecting them in Turkey. You got a major infection. But what, they also have a major fascination for you?
Yes, they are actually my primary target of my research. I've been working on them for many, many years. They have fascinated me because they combine everything that I love about nature. They are beautiful. They play important roles in the ecosystem, and they live in places that I've always wanted to visit. We have some of them, of course, here, but not nearly as many as in tropical countries.
And they have that sound.
Yes.
We should mention that you're also the director of the Invertebrate Diversity Initiative of Conservation International. What do you see as the prospects for the smaller majority? Are there going to be extinct ones, and what does that mean?
We now estimate that about 1,000 species of small animals go extinct, permanently go extinct every year. That's a really, really scary thing. The only real way to save them, just like, you know, we can save bigger animals and plants that are also endangered, is the preservation of their habitats. Halting logging and restricting mining and such activities have much, much greater impact on conservation of these smaller animals and life in general.
And as you said, the reason for doing it is that they keep many of these habitats alive.
Yes, yes.
It's just a lovely book, and once you look in the eyes of some of these little creatures, people may think more about preserving them. Peter Ness Krecky, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Harvard Research Associate Peter Ness Krecky, his new book is called The Smaller Majority. For pictures, by the way, go to our website, here-now.org.
Was a bug, little bug, hardly there.
We had to. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Without any evidence,
his claws were many.
He was full of confidence.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.